Good morning. It's 9:06. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn this week on the Ideas Network. I am told that Kathleen will be back on the air next Tuesday morning, so we'll welcome her with open arms. President Bush and House Democrats locked horns last week over immunity for telecommunications companies who cooperated with the administration's domestic wiretapping program. Over the weekend, the Protect America Act expired, with the House and Senate divided on the telecommunications immunity issue. The president warned of dire consequences, while House Speaker Nancy Pelosi accused President Bush of fear-mongering. Meanwhile, back at the Supreme Court, the court let stand without comment a lower court ruling that threw out an ACLU lawsuit that challenged the warrantless wiretapping program, and the FBI had some of its wiretaps cut off because the bills didn't get paid. The FISA law is still on the books, and by FISA we mean the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act of 1978. But what effect does it still have with all the modifications? This is a pretty complex issue. In fact, it's so complex, we're going to have three different guests on this hour to try to help us sort through it. First, we're going to talk with Bill Weaver, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Texas, El Paso, and we'll start out by trying to get an overview of FISA. Good morning, Professor Weaver. Thanks for taking time to talk with us this morning.
Good morning, John.
Now, as I mentioned earlier, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, or FISA, became the law of the land in 1978. Why was this law passed originally, and what was it supposed to do?
The original purpose of the law was actually to constrain the president from engaging in warrantless surveillance of U.S. citizens. It was a reaction to the obvious abuses of power of Richard Nixon, but that's the most obvious abuse. Presidents since FDR had engaged in warrantless surveillance of U.S. citizens for wide-ranging reasons, not having to do with foreign intelligence, oftentimes having to do with personal vendettas, or having to do with for political reasons. So after the events of the Nixon White House, Congress saw that there was a need to place all wiretaps under judicial control. And so they came up with FISA as a way of doing this. So the primary motivation for FISA was not to collect foreign intelligence. There was no doubt that the president was already doing that without warrant. The goal of FISA was to put these presidential actions under control, or desires to wiretap U.S. citizens and others under control of the courts, and a process where there would be some accountability.
Now, the act created a court which meets in secret and approves or denies requests for search warrants. I mean, there's a process, or there was a process in place for obtaining warrants under the Constitution, upon presentation of evidence that there was reason to suspect something going on, that kind of thing. But there was also provision for emergencies, wasn't there, under this law? Wasn't there the ability to do some wiretapping or surveillance without an order?
Yes, there is. There's an emergency provision. The president and the Department of Justice has to go to the court post the emergency within a specified period of time, 72 hours, I believe, and then seek the warrant after the fact. But that's been used very rarely, to the best of my knowledge. The process is almost completely opaque. There has never been an affidavit or an application for a FISA warrant that has ever been made public. And we're talking about since 1978, there have been over 20,000 warrants filed. Of those 20,000, four have been denied, to the best of my knowledge. So even though there is a process, it is not a public process. There is absolutely no sunlight on it at all. Now there are 11 judges. Originally there were 7 judges. And you can simply wait, if you want to get a warrant, until the rotation comes up with the judge that is probably the one that will apply the least scrutiny to it. So, it is a process, but, in my opinion, it is not a very onerous process, and has been made less onerous over the years. So it is something that, probably needs to be looked at very carefully, and probably needs to have an introduction of accountability into the process.
Now, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act was modified in 2001 under the provisions of the Patriot Act, I believe.
Yes.
What changes did they make then?
Okay. There are two chief statutes governing surveillance in the United States, and the first is called Title III of the Omnibus Crime and Control Act of 1968. And those viewers who've seen the show The Wire, a great program, that's what that's dealing with, Title III wires or T3 wires. And that's what people generally think of when they think of wiretaps. The other statute is FISA. Now, the reason people don't generally think of FISA is because there are a limited number of judges that issue FISA warrants. Under T3, any federal judge can issue a FISA warrant, and state judges, too. So it's a controlled process with a limited amount of judges. What people don't realize is that probably 90% of all the surveillance engaged in by the U.S. federal government is under FISA, not under a Title III warrant. So what happened was this. Up to 2001, there was a rule that was employed, and it was called the wall, and there was a secondary rule, which is in the statute, which said that the primary purpose of a warrant issued in FISA had to be to collect foreign intelligence. Well, in 2001, the Patriot Act, probably the most substantial change that was made to FISA was that they got rid of this primary purpose provision. So the primary purpose no longer had to be to collect foreign intelligence. All that was required is that collection of foreign intelligence must be a purpose. Now, I can't really overemphasize what a dramatic change that caused. And the change was essentially to shift FISA from an intelligence collection tool to a law enforcement tool. What that has done is that has allowed the infiltration of prosecutors into the process who now have great incentive to use FISA over Title III where possible, because FISA is a much more flexible tool. The surveillance lasts much longer. It is far more pervasive. It applies to sometimes entire facilities rather than just a person. And so if you're a prosecutor, you really want to go under FISA, at least preliminarily, because to suck up as much information as possible. So, I mean, not to get too complicated, but the shift in the Patriot Act was to make FISA more of a law enforcement tool, and then it kind of hedges out Title III and puts the Fourth Amendment in danger, if that makes any sense.
Well, it makes sense to me. Let's find out what some of our callers might think. Let me give the phone numbers before we go any further. 800-486-8655. If questions about the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act and its successor, the Protect America Act, which we'll get to in just a moment. 800-486-8655. That's a toll-free number. If you're in Milwaukee, please use our local number, which is 227-2050, 227-2050. I'm talking with Professor Bill Weaver, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Texas, El Paso, and he's helping us to get an overview of this Surveillance Act. So the Patriot Act, the changes that were made push this more toward the area of law enforcement than foreign intelligence gathering. I think it seems to me, I recall reading that there was one other thing that they did in that bill, which had to do with including terrorism as something that could be included in the scope of the FISA court. I think it... And, well, I should just ask you because you're the expert. I'm just the host here. But wasn't there something where they had to add some language to include terrorism because the original law basically pointed at foreign governments?
Right. They broadened up the language to include, wisely, to include activity more than just foreign intelligence and to include terroristic acts and things of that nature for as long as there is a foreign connection to it, that there is a, what they did is they, you know, generally FISA contemplated that it would be someone acting inside the United States as an agent of a foreign power or state. What the Patriot Act did was widen that up to include groups, terrorist organizations, not just foreign states, things of that nature. It also increased the number of judges on the court from 7 to 11. Anticipating correctly that there would be a great increase in the warrants that were applied for after 9/11.
Okay, so fast forward, we get to 2007, and in the meantime, we've discovered that there is a fairly, or we think there is, and there's so very little that's known for certain about any of this, that there's been some warrantless surveillance that's taken place. outside of the FISA law, it's alleged that the large telecommunications companies, some of them, cooperated with this surveillance, eventually, sort of after the fact, we get the Protect America Act, which I believe became law last August, but it had a sunset provision, and this past weekend it expired because Congress couldn't agree on the very issue of telecommunications immunity, which we'll get to in the second half hour of the program. I don't want to get to that right now, but what was the justification that was used by the administration to get around having to go to the FISA court either before or after the fact to obtain warrants for the surveillance that was done?
Okay, well, I think the word alleged is a little too careful. The president himself has admitted the terrorist surveillance program and the fact that telecommunications companies assisted in that. So there were two programs, apparently. One was a program that was, for want of a better term, was data mining. It was a wide collection of information without individualized suspicion. Now, that's important. And the second one was apparently a targeted program where they did have individualized suspicion and they were engaging in warrantless surveillance. Now, the first one, the kind of data mining program, the reason they couldn't go to the FISA court for that program was FISA, still, even as broad and flexible as it is, requires individualized suspicion. You have to go to the court and say, we think this person is an agent of a foreign power or terrorist organization, and you got to give the court a quantum of evidence to that end, tell the court what you want with regard to that person. But if you have a data mining program, you don't have any individualized suspicion. It's actually the reverse. What you're doing is you're looking at lots and lots of information trying to come up with individualized suspicion. You couldn't very well go to the court and say, look, we want to surveil a whole bunch of people and then try to figure out which are the ones that are the threats to the United States. So that's one of the main reasons that they had to bypass FISA, is because it simply wouldn't wash, in my opinion, with any federal judge. It would be a violation of the Fourth Amendment.
This is, I think that practice is also called drift netting. Something like that. The United States has done that in foreign countries for years. The National Security Administration, I mean, that's one of the things they do is go through all of the electronic communications of foreign powers that we may be interested in and try and figure out what they're saying and all of that. I mean, but this is that's always been, or at least as far as we know, always been focused outside the United States and aimed at foreign governments. In the Cold War, it was the Soviet Union and whatever satellite states and so forth. But now it appears that this was going on in the United States itself and outside of any court scrutiny. The Protect America Act of 2007 was a major overhaul, or was supposed to be a major overhaul, of FISA. And I want to talk about that a little bit. And we've got some people who are waiting to talk to us. First, we need to take a quick break, and then we'll be right back. We're talking about the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act and its successor laws and changes and so forth, and what's going on with it now. And we invite your participation as well at 800-486-8655 and 227-2050. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 9:21. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today. Kathleen, we'll be back behind the microphone next Tuesday. Middle age has its ups and downs. You may be a little bit wiser, but you just can't see as well as you used to. It can be a little depressing. And if you are middle-aged and feeling down, you're not alone. Researchers have found that middle-aged depression is a phenomenon across the globe. After two on Talk of the Nation, feeling blue in one's 40s. Geez, I felt pretty good in my 40s. It's the 50s I'm having trouble with. Anyway, that's later on today here on the Ideas Network. This hour, we're talking about the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act and the evolution of that and its successors and all the revisions and what it means. Trying to sort this out, and in our second half hour, we'll talk about some more specific issues related to FISA. In this portion of the program, we're talking with Bill Weaver, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Texas, El Paso, who's kind of helping us get a handle on all of this. Now, I said I wanted to take some calls when we got back, and I want to make sure I get these in before the end of the half hour, because your questions are probably better than mine. Let's go first to Jerry in Waterford. Jerry, good morning. Thanks so much for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to ask Mr. Weaver, in regards to my understanding after reading the 9/11 report, that the changes in the FISA law was recommended by the 9/11 Commission because of the fact that there was not cooperation between the FBI and the CIA, and they pinpointed that to an interpretation made by the two agencies of the FISA law. In fact, and I'm quoting from memory now, is I believe it was Judge Blackburn said that he wanted to see all the wiretapping for both domestic and foreign because of the fact that the wiretapping was only supposed to be for foreign agents. Is that correct?
This is true. What you're referring to is something that was created in the 80s and then kind of perfected in the 90s. It was called the wall. And the wall was the principle that you could not, if you had foreign intelligence, you could not contact prosecutors and you could not contact agents, right, who were working in conjunction with prosecutors. You couldn't pass anything over the wall unless you went through special procedures. So what you ended up with is you had a really asymmetrical status of information. So you'd have some people in the intelligence community who would have information about, you know, perhaps lots of criminal activity, and then you would have the agents and prosecutors who would be investigating and charging such activity not have the information and couldn't get it. This created lots of problems, I believe, and the wall was probably far more strict than was necessary. However, the principle that underlies the wall is an interesting one, and I think it's important, and that is that if you could pass information under FISA at will to prosecutors, then prosecutors would end up taking over FISA activity and directing it, and that they would positively try to circumvent Title III warrants. Title III warrants are much, much harder to obtain than FISA warrants. And so the idea was that prosecutors may very well be tempted to undermine the Fourth Amendment by going around Title III. FISA is questionable whether or not it complies with the Fourth Amendment on many occasions. But you're right, it has created a problem. And, you know, on the one hand, we want to have an efficacious investigation and prosecution of criminal activity. On the other hand, we don't want to get rid of the Fourth Amendment in the process and empower prosecutors to control all surveillance. So it's a dilemma. And it was a dilemma that was fairly much resolved in 2001 by the Patriot Act. Now FISA is pretty much in the hands of prosecutorial authorities when they want it. Right? And so that makes me worry to some degree for the Fourth Amendment.
Jerry, thanks for the call. Let's go next to Dave in Ellison Bay. Dave, good morning.
Thank you for taking my call. I guess my question has to do with sort of what your guest just referred to, and that is, how these so-called protections or broaden, you know, where the federal government has now better tools to supposedly deal with foreign terrorism, how U.S. citizens who could be characterized in some way, shape, or form, I guess, domestic terrorists. I'm sure that the federal government is more concerned or has concerns for domestic terrorism. And I just wonder how these, how the Patriot Act and these other recent acts do affect U.S. citizens who could be, you know, actually just on the basis of allegations considered to be terrorists.
The FISA is incredibly flexible, and judges now are prevented from really going behind the scenes and asking operational details of agents and affiants, right, who come before the court. So what the court has been reduced to essentially is a rubber stamp. As long as the affidavit and the application meet pro forma standards and that it is certified to by a high government official, which it has to be, usually one of the top three in Department of Justice, then the FICR, which is the Foreign Intelligence Court of Review, ruled in 2004 that they really can't go beyond that. So yeah, I wonder too. And if you add to that, for example, Justice Scalia, when he was on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, once ruled that the Black Panthers would qualify as a terrorist organization with foreign connections. Now, so you wonder what. Where does this stop? I mean, is the American Library Association, because it deals a lot with, foreign entities as well. And, you wonder how far this gets stretched. And because FISA is so flexible, and because the standard to get a warrant under FISA is much lower than under Title III, you don't have to show probable cause of a crime. You only have to show probable cause that someone is acting as agent of a foreign power, and many courts or many judges have stated that that's really just a reasonable belief. So, yeah, I guess the answer is that since the process is so completely opaque, we just don't have any idea what's going on. And now, since it's become more of a pro forma process, then the possibility for abuse arises, and there has been abuse. I mean, in an extraordinary case of several years ago, all of the judges on the FISA court agreed to release an opinion, and in that opinion, was a flat statement that the court had simply been lied to on several occasions by FBI agents, and one FBI agent was banned from the court in perpetuity from being an affiant.
Could I ask a follow-up question?
Sure, go ahead.
So in other words, what you're saying, if I understand you correctly, is that people, U.S. citizens, people that would be perhaps considered fringe, whether you want to call them parts of the Patriot Movement, whatever, but just in general, people that have concerns about the broadness or the vagueness of this surveillance capability have legitimate concerns. Is that correct?
Yes, I believe they do. The process, in my opinion, well, it's opaque, so we don't know, but the process seems to be incredibly malleable, and it also seems to have... the short answer is yes. I believe that the concerns are quite legitimate.
Thank you very much, Dave, for that call. Appreciate it. And Professor Weaver, thank you for being with us. You have to leave us now, I understand. Mm-hmm. Appreciate your participation and helping us to get some of the background on this and try and put some structure to this discussion, because there are so many issues and they're so complicated, it's kind of tough to do in an hour, but we'll give it our best shot. Thank you for helping us out this morning.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure, John.
We're going to welcome now a guest that is going to help us with another piece of this puzzle. Tony Seebach is professor of law, the Benjamin Cardozo School of Law at Yeshiva University, and he's joining us by phone. Professor, good morning.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Well, not too bad so far, but it's only 9:30, so
yeah.
have to leave room for growth. One of the things that we've kind of gotten with the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, we kind of did a little historical piece in this the first half hour of the program, talking about kind of how we got to 2007, which was the passage of the Protect America Act, which has just expired over the weekend. And the reason that it was allowed to expire, or one of them, there were a number of reasons, but the practical reason was that the Senate and the House did not agree on whether or not there should be retroactive immunity for the telecommunications companies that went along with the Bush administration's domestic surveillance program from prosecution or from lawsuits. And I guess that's kind of where I want to go with this next part of the discussion, which is to talk about telecommunication immunity. Hopefully we can sort this out as well. These issues are incredibly complex. There's a lot of legal stuff, I guess. I'll just use that word. It's not a very good one, but it'll suffice for now. Here that the average person, including myself, probably doesn't need to know about necessarily, but we'll try and stay on some of the bigger principles, and particularly I'd like to focus on the constitutional principles involved here as well. I guess the first question that I have is how do you grant immunity? How do you grant immunity when it hasn't been established that in any court that a crime has been committed? That would be one question. And if you're asserting that you didn't do anything wrong, why would you want to then make companies immune if they weren't doing anything wrong? I guess those are two questions, but that's where we can start, and then we'll move on from there.
Well, I think it's easiest to answer the second question. The second question is basically that in the real world, where nobody really knows until there's a final judgment, either in terms of a criminal or civil case, whether or not, legally speaking, they've done anything wrong, they'd like to know in advance that they don't have to worry about that. The main purpose of immunity, especially in private law for damages, is to give people comfort, that they no longer have that sort of Damocles hanging over their head. And there's nothing wrong with that. There's a lot of laws, there are a lot of doctrines that we have that provide immunity for people who aren't clear whether, if they really went to the bitter end of a trial, they'd be held liable. And that's just simply so they can stop paying their lawyers and they can stop worrying about whether or not they're going to be liable. So immunity in itself is a perfectly reasonable thing to provide people, especially in circumstances of indeterminacy, where they just don't know what would happen if a jury heard all the facts. It gives people comfort, and you need comfort in order to make it through life. You need it, especially if you're a corporation, in order to know how much money is set aside for potential damages and how much money you're going to be spending next year for legal fees. So immunity is a perfectly reasonable device that we have, and we use it a lot. My complaint is really on the front half of it, which is there's another party involved here, not just the defendant. There's also the plaintiff. The plaintiff doesn't know whether or not they actually have a claim that's worth something. And to say that it's going to be given a value of zero when they think it's there's a reasonable chance that they might have a good case is essentially to take away something from them as well, and not to give them something of value. And the question, the constitutional question, is whether or not the government can do that.
And the American Civil Liberties Union filed a lawsuit, and the Supreme Court, a lower court, said that they didn't have standing because they couldn't prove they were harmed. The Supreme Court let that ruling stand. They didn't even comment on it. Isn't part of the problem in bringing a suit here is that no one knows who actually had surveillance done on them, and so you are how would you go about establishing standing if you thought that this program was illegal, but you couldn't get any details of it?
Well, so let's separate three points. First of all, our conversation we're having right now is really about civil liability, not about whether or not there's going to be criminal prosecution, because as far as I can tell, and probably under FISA, there may be, I didn't hear the first half of your program, there may be provisions under which the Justice Department can litigate, can prosecute the phone companies. Certainly under this administration, that's not going to happen, and I doubt even under a future administration that will happen. It seems to me a perfectly appropriate case for prosecutorial discretion not to pursue criminal penalties against the telecoms. And I'm not here to talk about criminal prosecution. It's just not the topic I'm interested in talking about. I'm talking about private law, that is, the rights of one citizen versus another, and the role of government in adjudicating those rights. Now, on the question of civil liability, my understanding is that in Northern District of California, the district court judge has, in fact, allowed the litigation to go forward. The Electronic Freedom Foundation has brought suits in which they claim, and the district court judge has agreed, that there's a chance that they'll be able to show that there is a harm to identifiable parties. The standing question is not over. The Ninth Circuit is currently reviewing it. Now, if you ask me, what do I think about the standing question? I've got two answers. One is, let's not immunize the defendants if, in fact, we can resolve this by looking at the standing question in due course. There's no reason to have immunity if the defendants have a good standing argument. Let them raise the standing argument and let them win it. There's a very simple way of handling it. It's called argument in front of the judge. Secondly, it is a little weird, actually, for anyone to claim a legal victory on the basis that even if I harm someone, you can't find out who they were. It might be a good argument in class actions. We've seen, for example, various defendants wiggle out of liability by saying that the plaintiffs will never be able to find out who among the thousands of people took this product were actually injured. But we often and recently have refused to allow that to happen, and we have equitable doctrines to require the defendant to somehow provide compensation into a fund or into some kind of public-oriented pool of money. So at least say that even if we can't find out who to give the money to, you shouldn't be allowed to keep the fruits of your wrongful conduct.
We're talking about the genesis of this discussion is the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act and then its successor law, the Protect America Act, which expired over the weekend due to political wrangling over telecommunications immunity in this case, I believe, from both civil and criminal prosecution. And we're focusing on the civil aspects of it in this half hour and some of the constitutional questions that we'll probably raise. I want to welcome another guest who joins us also by phone. Jeff LaMonaco is Assistant Professor of Political Science at the University of Minnesota. Good morning, Professor.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, thanks for being here. And sometimes with two phone guests, things can get a little confusing for the host, who's easily confused anyway. I'll try and keep things from getting too confusing. I want to give the phone numbers because I'm sure that we have a lot of people who would like to ask either one of you some questions about FISA in general, in which case Jeff will take those. And Tony is here to answer specific questions about telecommunications immunity and things related directly to that. 800-486-8655 is the toll-free number that you can call to join this program, 800-486-8655. 227-2050 is the number you should use if you're calling us from Milwaukee, 227-2050. You can also send an email. The address is talk@wpr.org. We're talking about the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, or FISA, and its successor laws, and the whole aspect of domestic surveillance and the dispute that is going on between the President and Congress over immunity for telecommunications companies. You're invited to join the discussion at the numbers I just gave. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll continue to talk with our guests and with you. I'm John Munson, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn, and you're tuned to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 20 minutes before 10 o'clock. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Well, next hour, we're going to talk about Abraham Lincoln. And a new book is out about Lincoln called The Most Frequently Asked Questions About President Lincoln. Actually, the main title of the book is Did Lincoln Own Slaves? And Other Frequently Asked Questions About Abraham Lincoln. And you'll get to ask your questions as well. We have the author joining us after the news at the top of the hour. So that's what's coming up here on the Ideas Network. This hour, perhaps a little weightier topic in terms of current events. The domestic surveillance that's taken place over the last 7 or 8 years and the law surrounding that. In 2007, Congress passed the Protect America Act, which was an overhaul of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, and which was originally passed in 1978, and as we heard in the first half of the program, was an outgrowth of the whole Church Committee and the things that had been going on since Roosevelt. And perhaps before. But in 2007, in August, the Protect America Act became the law of the land, but it had a sunset provision, and it sunsetted, and the sun went down on it over the weekend because it was not renewed. So now we're left with kind of a dispute, and apparently what would happen is the previous law that was on the books is the one that remains in force. And I'll direct this question to Jeff LaMonaco. Is that the case? The FISA law is amended by the Patriot Act in 2001 would still be in force, even with the Protect America Act not in force. Is that correct?
That's correct. That's correct. That's exactly right. When the House declined to act most recently, essentially what happened is that the Protect America Act lapsed, but that left the pre-existing FISA regime in place. And also, my understanding is that surveillance that was undertaken, that was begun under the Protect America Act, basically is going to be able to continue for another year. So in other words, as of now, there's no change from when the Protect America Act was in place.
Well, now we heard earlier in the hour, we had Professor Weaver on from the University of Texas, El Paso. We heard when the Patriot Act was passed, the changes that were made in the FISA law at that time made it easier for prosecutors to engage FISA as a process, and made some other changes as well to the way the FISA law worked. It increased the court to 11 members and added terrorism as something that could fall under FISA, because it was clear that we needed to do something to change that, since foreign governments weren't always involved in this. What changes did the Protect America Act make to the FISA law? How did that? What tinkering was done under that?
Well, a number of things were done. I mean, one of the original main aims was to make it easier to deal with a situation where you may have foreign. One of the changes that was, you know, on the table was foreign to foreign communications that may pass through the United States. That's one of the things that's been at issue. But also other provisions. There was a mechanism put in place to essentially get a warrant that could last for a year. That's one of the sort of key provisions, so that you could basically get a warrant that could last for a year. That also, again, as best as I can understand, it's a fearsomely complicated topic. But basically, the warrant could be what are called basket warrants. That is to say, they weren't necessarily individualized warrants aimed at a particular individual, but they would, you know, be warrants that could be aimed sort of at more at a kind of particular operation. And again, the warrants would last for a year. And that's one of the key things that, again, is as a practical matter, any of those warrants that were obtained between the passage of the Protect America Act and now, those remain, you know, in effect. Even though the law itself has lapsed, those remain in effect. Again, if we go for another year without any updating, at that point, that particular way of doing things would no longer be possible, and we would go back to the pre-Protect America Act FISA regime, basically. So that's one of the main things that happened.
Okay. We have a caller, I think, who wants to talk about the telecommunications aspect, company aspect of this, and I want to get to him next. But first, to preface this, one of the main reason that the Protect America Act didn't get renewed was that the House and Senate couldn't agree on telecommunications immunity. And that's we have Tony Seebach on the line with us to talk about that. And I'd like to take a caller who has a question or a comment regarding that. We'll go to Mike in Oshkosh next and see what Mike has to say. Mike, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, good morning. I think I've been following this fairly closely. And from what I understand, the reason the House and the Senate, the Senate passed it, the reason the House weren't able to address it was mostly because of a timing thing. They felt a little bullied by the Senate, giving them only 2 days to handle the various issues involved. Anyhow, that's the way Rockefeller described it, and I tend to believe him. But when it comes to the telecommunications issue itself, I actually agree with the administration that we're going to these telecommunication companies and asking for their cooperation. They don't make a penny on this thing. We're throwing them out there, making them completely open to lawsuits when they really have no advantage in this thing other than helping their government in this, you know, this war on terror. So if we're to leave them liable to lawsuits, and let's be honest here, we got the Democratic Party is completely connected at the hip to the trial lawyers lobby. That's why, you know, you can't address the medical malpractice things very much because of the trial lawyers. When you have the trial lawyers just hovering over this issue, if I were a telecommunications company, I would be somewhat threatened by that. So I would want immunity, and I would walk away from this thing if I didn't have that immunity. So that's essentially how I feel on this telecommunications thing.
Professor Seebach, you want to comment on that?
It's a very, very valid observation. One issue of a fact is that one of the telecommunications companies actually did walk away from the request from the federal government. Quest refused to comply with the request from the government because, opinion of their lawyers, they were being asked to break the law. and they were being asked to impose damages on other people, and they refused to do that. Now, the solution, you say, well, we put these companies between a rock and a hard place. I don't think it's as much of a rock as people say it is, because at least one company figured out they didn't have to do it, and there was no ramifications. Now, however, you know, people make mistakes. They read the law wrong. They impose liability on others. What happens? Well, one solution, it's not what I recommend, but one solution, a middle ground that both sides of this debate could have gone to, which I'm surprised has never been raised, is to do exactly what we did after 9/11. After 9/11, credible claims were made. I was actually very skeptical of them, but many other people thought they were credible, that corporations, airlines, the Port Authority, the manufacturers of the airplanes, had acted in ways that imposed costs on other citizens. They were liable in lawsuits. Lawsuits were initiated. What did our government do? It stepped in and it indemnified the corporations. They said, you know what? Let's cut off the litigation and we'll pay the damages in a compensation fund. And everybody thought this was great. Now, I don't know why we don't do that here. It's a very simple point I'm making, a very simple point. I actually have no opinion whether there should be or should not be liability under FISA. I have a very different viewpoint. Once we make the law, once we create a civil liability, that is a piece of property that the victim owns. And you can't take that away. Someone's got to pay for it. And if the corporations don't go to trial and discover whether they have to pay for it, if the government wants to sort of preempt that process, then the government has to pay for it. It's a takings. That's what we did after 9/11. That's what we should do here probably.
All right. Thanks a lot for that call. And let's go next to Midge in Madison. Midge, good morning. Thanks for calling and joining our program today.
Yes, I have a question. You know, we've had a lot of talk about the mercenaries that we have contracted out our military to, like Blackwater and all. But I understand that there has been a lot of contracting out of our intelligence services. And there's practically no mention of that because people don't talk much about what's happening in the intelligence service. And I'm wondering if these groups would get involved in this kind of thing, whether they might not be as accountable or as well trained as our own intelligence services, and whether one of the firewalls to keep the wrong things from happening would be companies refusing to do something that seems wrong, and if they know that they can be let off for whatever happens just because they've been asked to do it, then I don't think we will have that protection of people having any judgment as to what they do and what they don't do. And that's why the FISA law was put in. It was so there would be some court who could make a judgment on what individuals were doing. And I'm wondering how this will affect the intelligence agencies.
Okay, Mitch, thanks for that. I'm not quite sure how to direct that. There's a lot there.
I can take a crack at it if you want.
Go ahead.
I mean, it's a great question, and what I would say is I do think that it points to sort of one of the big issues sort of lurking in the telecom immunity debate. I'd be interested to hear what Professor Seebach has to say about this, but it strikes me that one of the big issues lurking there is simply that going forward, you know, specifically in a post 9/11 context, there's going to be a whole number of issues where questions of intelligence gathering do have to depend on basically public-private cooperation, and the telecommunications are obviously going to be a major player there. And I do think that there is a real concern about the possibility that essentially the government would be able to use private companies to do things that otherwise would be completely illegal for the government to do in various kinds of invasions of privacy and that sort of thing. And so that I think that that's one of the sort of big issues sort of that needs a good public airing, because there's just no question that it seems to me that there's going to have to be, there's going to be a lot of surveillance, and it's going to involve public-private cooperation. And we need to figure out a way to make sure that the private part of that isn't used to kind of end run around, basically, you know, traditional and well-founded limitations on what government is able to do with in relation to the citizens, basically.
Professor Seebach, would you like to take a shot at this, too?
Yeah, it's a very interesting question in the following sense. The one thing that I think, I agree with what has been said previously, the one thing I want to sort of observe, and it's ironic, I'm about to teach this to my students in about 5 minutes, existing law that controls you or me as private citizens from engaging in violations of a people's privacy for which we could be held liable civilly and have all, you know, ever been for about 70 years now since the right to privacy was developed, are pretty stiff. There's a lot of constraints on what we can do, not only in terms of public law but also in private law. And what actually is the interesting thing is that because of the immunities that have always been in place, the power of a citizen to use the courts to go after a government actor has always been much less than the power of a citizen to go after a private actor. And so when we talk about private contractors, the truth is it's when they act as an agent of the government that they gain protections they wouldn't otherwise have. If Blackwater did what it did, you know, outside of its employment as a government agent, it would be much easier to sue it. So the reality is that what we have to watch is we have to watch a structure in which private actors who are not easily observed by people inside the government gain the immunity that typically government actors have. And that's actually what just happened, and we have to be very careful to make sure that those actors don't slip between two chairs. The law is pretty good about controlling private actors. It's just when private actors get the protections that we usually give government actors without the supervision that we normally have for regular government actors that we begin to have problems.
Let's take a call from Scott in La Crosse next. Scott?
Hi there.
Good morning.
Good morning to all of you. And my question, I hope it's not too far afield, but mine really relates to just the simple effectiveness of what they seem to be doing, and what I'm referring to is this. Remember a few months back, there was testimony from some retired, and I think maybe AT&T engineer, I'm not sure who, but anyhow, he made the point that when he was working, and when he was still working, he was seeing all kinds of telecom communications being funneled through the government. And it wasn't just selected, it was just this huge funnel, and they could pick out anything they wanted or copy anything. And my question is, in all that chaff, how in the heck are they going to find any wheat? Because it seems to me if you're going so broad, you really ruin your effectiveness. And I know everybody says, oh yeah, well, they've got computer programs that can look for strings of data and references and names and things like that. Well, yeah, but you know, as somebody who gets joke email, you know, you see the thing about, you know, Bin Laden this, Bin Laden that, and believe me, this has nothing to do with terrorism. It's only done for some kind of a, you know, a funny picture or a joke or anything like that. And if you write in a computer program, how do you even weed out that chaff and get the weed out of it?
You're talking about the practice of drift netting for intelligence, which I think is one of the things that's been discussed. We did talk a little bit about that in the first half hour, but Jeff, you want to take a shot at that for a couple of minutes about a half a minute here?
I mean, it's partly beyond my technical competence, I would say. What I would say is essentially that, you know, my understanding is that there are a variety of techniques, what you're talking about, data mining being one of them, you know, that are sort of designed to do this. To be honest, I honestly have no idea how well they do it. I mean, I presume that it's in their interest to develop ways of figuring out how to separate out particularly the kinds of things you're talking about, right? That is to say, to design it in such a way that, you know, these techniques in such a way that they're capable of sort of distinguishing, you know, the sorts of joke things that you're talking about from non-jokes. But, you know, I have no idea what those would be, to be quite honest.
Professor Seebach, we've only got about a half a minute left here before we have to get going, and I know you have to get to class, but I just wanted to get your take. Now, there's a suit that's still active in the Ninth Circuit, Is that suit likely to end up before the Supreme Court at some point?
No, I actually think that there are too many other reasons why, outside of the immunity issue, these suits will fail. The fact that we don't know exactly who has been injured is a huge problem. But there's also the State Secrets Act, which is the amount of confidential or state secrets that would have to be examined even by the court in a secure location makes bringing these lawsuits very cumbersome. And I think that I want to go back to a previous point made, then I will rush off the class. The purpose of this litigation, in all due respect to the trial lawyers, is not to make a lot of money. There's not a lot of money to be made here. The purpose of these lawsuits are symbolic. And in some sense, I sympathize with the critics of the lawsuits, which is, well, if that's what the goal is, isn't there a better way to get your point across? Maybe there is. I actually think the Republicans and Democrats should think of a creative solution here. The truth is we made a promise to the people of America when we passed these laws. Maybe we shouldn't have made that promise. But once we made that promise, we just can't break it. Maybe some kind
of promise I made a promise to get off the air within 10 seconds here, so I have to do that. Thank you both for an interesting hour. Appreciate
Thanks
it.
Thanks very much.
I'm John Munson. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.